We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities. Please take the order of service home and read the announcements that are listed in it. In addition, here are a few others. The annual meeting is next week, immediately following services. The service dues should be in by then. We have 5 bags of coffee left, both regular and decaf. Please help us sell the last of our stock. It is for sale in the social hall. Next week is flower communion. Please bring a flower to contribute, a nice fresh flower to contribute to our flower communion. And the kayak auction ends today at noon. So if you're interested in that, put a bid out in the box in the foyer. Last weekend, some of our youth and adult helped clean up Fowler Lake. They got in canoes and kayaks and went around the lake into the Oconomowoc River, grabbing bottles, bags, and even fished some tires out of the river. Unfortunately, when the group returned back to land, one of the kayaks didn't make it back to the Haskell's house across from the lake. It appears to have been stolen, along with a paddle and life vest. We will be holding a car wash on Saturday, July 24th, to raise money toward replacing the missing items. Anyone who would like to help and or get their car washed that day, please join us. If you would like to contribute toward replacing the boat, there will be a basket in the social hall for donations. Thank you for your help. Today is the last day for the sharing the ministry. People offering their time, talents, muscle power, and creativity is what keeps this church alive and strengthens connections with each other. We call it sharing the ministry when we work together to fulfill our mission and vision and help each other. Some of the possibilities include publicity, fundraising, finance, adult enrichment, Baker's Club, Caring Circle, and much more. Please take a look at all the possibilities and sign up today. I invite you to greet those sitting around you. If you are visiting us today with children, or if you've been visiting us today, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger in our visitors' table in the foyer. There are a variety of information available on the table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church. Or if you've been visiting for a while and would like information about becoming a member, I'd be happy to talk with you about that as well. If you're visiting with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to the religious education classes. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service. If you would like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just outside the doors to my right and across the entryway if there's a need for child care during the service. We always enjoy getting to know our guests. If any members have brought guests today, we would be pleased if you introduced them. If any guests have brought themselves and feel comfortable introducing themselves, this would be a good time to do so. We really enjoy meeting you.
I brought my good friend Tony here before, and I brought my mom Margie. So.
Welcome. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. Please put your cell phones on silent mode during the service. I hope you find this service worthwhile. Our speaker today is Paul Fackler, a lay member of our congregation.
We're actually going to start with our opening words instead of the prelude. The following speech was delivered by Abraham Lincoln on the afternoon of Thursday, November 19, 1863, at the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, 4.5 months after the Battle of Gettysburg, in which more than 7,500 people died, all Americans, fighting each other. The American Civil War would not end until after the surrender of Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia on April 9, 1865. Lincoln himself would die on April 15, 1865. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Please join in the singing of the chalice lighting as printed in the order of service. I invite the children to come forward to listen to the story of all ages.
Good morning. This story is entitled The Treehouse by Lois Lowry. It was a terrific treehouse. Better than terrific. It was a marvelous, magnificent, one-of-a-kind treehouse with wooden walls painted bright blue. It had two windows with red shutters, one each, and a yellow door with two shiny brass hinges and a small brass bell that rang when you pulled the string. There was a little porch where you could sit with your legs dangling. Inside were a table and a chair, a small rug with fringe on each end, and two fat pillows so that you could lie on the rug and read. You reached it by climbing the ladder, a ladder to the best treehouse ever, and it belonged to Chrissy. "It's all mine, isn't it?" she asked her grandfather after he built the house for her. "Just mine and nobody else's." Grandpa was washing the paintbrush. He nodded. "I built it just for you." So Chrissy used her markers and made a sign. Chrissy's house, the sign said. Keep out. She tacked it to the door. Then she took her favorite books into the treehouse, curled up on the pillows, and began to read. Chrissy? A voice came from the yard next door from just across the fence. Chrissy got up and looked through the treehouse window. Hi, Leah, she said to the girl who lived next door. How do you like my treehouse now that it's all done? It's beautiful, said Leah. What do you have inside? A table and two chairs and a rug and some pillows, Chrissy told her. And some secret stuff, she added. Though she really didn't have secret stuff, really. She planned to. Can I come up and see? Leah asked. No, Chrissy said. It's just for me. That's why I made the sign. Leah stood silently for a moment, and then she said, I don't like you, Chrissy. I don't like you either, Chrissy replied. She went back to the pillows and opened her book again. A short time later, she heard voices in the yard next door. She peered through the window and saw that Leah's father was there with Leah. They had a wheelbarrow full of old boards and a jar of nails. As Chrissy watched from her window, she saw Leah's father prop an old ladder against the trunk of the tree on the other side of the fence. Then after he jiggled the ladder and made certain it was steady, he climbed up carrying a board and began to nail it in place where the branches came together. He was making Leah a treehouse. Chrissy laughed to herself. Leah's father was at home because he had lost his job. She knew that they didn't have extra money now for things like paints and brass hinges. And Leah's treehouse would never be as good as hers. Never in a million years. Chrissy went back to her book and turned the pages while the hammering continued. That evening, after supper, Chrissy stood beside the fence and looked up at Leah's finished house. She laughed aloud. It had taken her grandpa a week to finish her beautiful treehouse. Grandpa had used new wooden boards from the lumber yard, but Leah's has been completed in just a day, and Chrissy could see that it was made from the stack of old weathered boards that had been in the corner of Leah's yard. Only one board remained there now. The others had become the treehouse. The house had walls and a porch and a door and two windows, but it had no shutters and no paint and no doorbell. The boards were crooked, and the roof had holes where the pieces of wood didn't quite meet. Even the sign wasn't as good, because Leah had done hers with crayons instead of a marking pen. But its message was the same. Leah's house, it said, keep out. Leah's head appeared in the window of her treehouse. Your house is not as nice as mine, Chrissy told her. Not on the outside, said Leah, but inside it's better. Chrissy wondered what Leah had inside her treehouse, but she didn't ask. For several days, the two girls didn't speak to each other. They sat alone in their treehouses. By the fourth day, Chrissy had finished all her books and had read some of them twice. She went to her window and called across the fence to Leah. Do you have any books I can borrow? She asked when Leah's head appeared. No, our car is broken, so we can't go to the library. You don't have any books at all? Leah shook her head. Chrissy sat down. She wondered what it would be like to be in a treehouse with no books at all. She wondered what Leah was doing there. Finally, she came across the fence again. Would you like to borrow some of mine? She asked, and Leah said yes. So Chrissy climbed down, stood at the fence, and handed two books over to Leah, who had climbed down her ladder too. I have some bananas, Leah told her. Do you want one? Chrissy nodded, and Leah climbed up and returned with the banana to pass across the fence. Back in her own treehouse, Chrissy peeled and ate the banana, and then she called to Leah again. Do you have a wastebasket in your house? I don't want to mess up my carpeting with this banana peel. Leah looked through the window and nodded. So Chrissy climbed down, and Leah climbed down, and Chrissy handed her the banana peel across the fence. Both girls climbed back into their houses. Chrissy sat alone and admired her fringe rug for a moment, and then leafed through her books again, wondering what Leah was doing. She called through her window. Leah? Leah looked out. What? I could come and visit you if you want, Chrissy said. Leah didn't answer. Or you could come visit me, Chrissy nodded. Your sign says keep out, Leah pointed. So does mine. Well, Chrissy suggested, we could change them. Leah nodded. Each girl removed their sign and crossed out the words keep out. They wrote welcome instead. they hung their signs. "You know what, Chrissy," Leah said, "you could use that wide board in the corner of my yard. It could go from your porch to my porch, over the top of the fence. Then we could visit each other by walking across the board." Chrissy eyed the distance and the height. "What if we fell?" "It's not very high," Leah pointed out, "and if we each came out halfway and held hands, we could help each other across." They climbed down their ladders. The wide board was heavy, but when each girl took an end, they were able to lift it into place. In a few minutes, they'd made a bridge between the houses over the top of the fence. Chrissy stepped from her treehouse porch onto the wide board, reached for Leah's waiting hand, and walked across. She entered Leah's house and looked around. There was no rug, and the only books were her own that Leah had borrowed. But there was a bowl of fruit, a wastebasket, and curtains at the windows. The walls were covered with portraits of beautiful women, the most beautiful women Chrissy had ever seen. "I like your art collection, Leah," Chrissy said. "They're left over from where my mom works," Leah explained. "She works at a beauty parlor and gets pictures of all new hairstyles. These are last year's. You can't tell, though. They look brand new." "My house isn't as nice as yours," Leah added. "I said it was better inside, but it isn't really." "I really don't have carpeting," Chrissy admitted. "Only an old rug, and I don't have curtains or a single picture on my walls. I could let you have one of my pictures, too, even. You can have the blonde shag and the auburn blunt cut. My grandpa had paint left over. He could paint the outside of your house so we'd match. But I'm afraid we don't have another doorbell." "Now that my sign says welcome, I don't think I need a doorbell," Leah said. "I don't really dislike you, Leah," Chrissy said. "I don't really dislike you either," Leah replied. They sat together on Leah's porch and looked around happily. "What do you think the best part of a treehouse is, Chrissy?" Leah asked. Chrissy thought. She looked over her own house with its shutters and brass hinges. She looked around Leah's with the bowl of bright apples and its yellow curtains. "The very best part," she said finally, "is the bridge." And that's our story for today. Thank you.
Please rise as you are able and join in the singing of hymn 360, "Here We Have Gathered." The offertory is a sacrament of the free church. It is supported by the generosity of all who join with us. The offering will be given and received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values.
Joys and concerns. If you have a joy or concern, one of our ushers will bring a microphone to you. Just raise your hand, state your joy or concern, and I will light a candle to commemorate that. I'll begin by lighting our memorial candle in memory of all those who have lost their lives in the service of our country, with an added thought that we can find more peaceful resolutions to our conflicts.
My name is Chris. Would you light two candles for me today? It's grandchildren.
I invite you to take a moment of silence after these words. Let us open our minds and hearts to the place of quiet, to the silent prayer for the healing of pain and the soft, gentle coming of love. Please rise as you are able and join in the centering hymn, number 123 in our hymnals. My reading is a poem by Michael Ondaatje, who some of you may know. He wrote The English Patient, Skin of a Lion, a number of other books that have been made into movies and things like that, but he's also a poet. And this is called To a Sad Daughter. All night long, the hockey pictures gaze down at you, sleeping in your tracksuit. Belligerent goalies are your ideal. Threats of being traded, cuts and wounds, all this pleases you. Oh, my God, you say at breakfast, reading the sports page over the Alpen as another player breaks his ankle or assaults a coach. When I thought of daughters, I wasn't expecting this, but I like this more. I like all your faults, even your purple moods, when you retreat from everyone to sit in bed under a quilt. And when I say like, I mean, of course, love, but that embarrasses you. You who feel superior to black and white movies, coaxed for hours to see Casablanca, though you were moved by Creature from the Black Lagoon. One day I'll come swimming beside your ship, or someone will, and if you hear the siren, listen to it. For if you close your ears, only nothing happens. You will never change. I don't care if you risk your life to angry goalies, creatures with webbed feet. You can enter their caves and castles, their glass laboratories. Just don't be fooled by anyone but yourself. This is the first lecture I've given you. Your sweet 16, you said. I'd rather be your closest friend than your father. I'm not good at advice. You know that, but ride the ceremonies until they grow dark. Sometimes you are so busy discovering your friends, I ache with loss. But that is greed. And sometimes I've gone into my purple world and lost you. One afternoon, I stepped into your room. You were sitting at the desk where I now write this. Forsythia outside the window and sun spilled over you. Like a thick yellow miracle, as if another planet was coaxing you out of the house. All those possible worlds, and you, meanwhile, busy with mathematics. I cannot look at Forsythia now without loss or joy for you. You step delicately into the wild world, and your real search will be the frantic search. And your real prize will be the frantic search. Want everything. If you break going out, not in. How you live your life, I don't care, but I'll sell my arms for you, hold your secrets forever. If I speak of death, which you fear now greatly, it is without answers, except that each one we know is in our blood. Don't recall graves. Memory is permanent. Remember the afternoon's yellow suburban annunciation. Your goalie, in his frightening mask, dreams perhaps of gentleness. You're going to be listening to me talk for a little while here, so bear with me. Monday is Memorial Day. I was originally going to ignore this, gloss over it. I picked a ready-made sermon from the Church of the Larger Fellowship called Practice Random Acts of Kindness and Senseless Acts of Beauty by the Reverend S. Gilbert. It's a nice sermon and a good counterpoint to the violence that's present in our society. But you're not going to hear it today. Instead, I have just taken these words from it. Reverend Gilbert writes, "On my good days, before I judge another as wanting in virtue, I try a flight of imagination. What must it be like to live inside his or her skin? What is the human history of this person I am so ready to condemn? What experiences have prompted the target of my scorn to behave in ways I judge to be so very wrong? In my wiser moments, I know I cannot enter into the feelings of another, nor bear with them the burden of their pain. But by trying, I enter into the fellowship of those who bear the mark of pain. Compassion is from the Latin compatior, to suffer with, to share solidarity with. Reverence for life, the core of my ethic, begins when I experience myself as a being who feels both pain and pleasure. Since others seem much like myself, likewise feeling pleasure and pain, I identify with them." Now hold that thought. In fact, I'm going to ask you to hold a variety of thoughts as we proceed. You can think of me today as a juggler, tossing a series of items into the air and hopefully catching them. Monday is Memorial Day. I mention this again because we forget things so quickly, and I forgot to tell you to remember this. And you, like me, may have reasons to not like or care about Memorial Day. I took the time to enumerate my reasons. Number one, consumerism. I know it's Memorial Day because there are Memorial Day sales. It seems rather ironic that we would use the memory of the death of people in the military to sell things. And yet we do. War has been a huge boost to our economy. Department of Defense spending in fiscal 2010 is up, as it has been year after year, to $664 billion, continuing to be larger than either Social Security or Medicare spending. And despite all the Memorial Day sales, Nerf guns are still full price at Toys R Us. Number two, patriotism, militarism. American flags are no doubt on sale this weekend, and there will be those who wrap themselves in a flag to hide or justify their dislike of those things non-American and to make political divisions. I distrust a strong outpouring of patriotism because of its past abuses. Senator Joseph McCarthy looms large in the recent past, particularly here in Wisconsin, as does Richard Nixon. We are perhaps too easily led, too easily fooled by jingoism, by fear. Number three, redundancy. How different is Memorial Day from Veterans Day or from the 4th of July? It seems to me we have a lot of days commemorating militarism and war. Where are our days about peace? Number four, death. Underneath any other trappings, this day is about people who have died while members of the military, people who have died fighting, people who died killing other people. As a pacifist, what can you say about this sadness? Can you thank someone for what you believe was a wrong action that was taken on your behalf? Are there justified wars and therefore justified deaths? And out of this murderous work, the death of heroes who we now honor? Stop there and hold those thoughts. Whether you agree or disagree, just hold them there for a moment. This is about juggling. I've tossed these into the air. They are my initial thoughts and feelings, unvarnished for the most part, and they bother me. They are ungracious. They lack compassion. Ah, yes, there's that word again, compassion. We're going to toss it back up into the air again for now. Monday is Memorial Day. You may have forgotten this because I was so busy indicating why Memorial Day can be ignored, why you should enjoy it as just another long weekend, that extra day off. But here it is back again. I looked up the history of Memorial Day on the internet and found Memorial Day was first enacted after the American Civil War to honor Union soldiers. It is celebrated near the day of reunification after the Civil War. It was later expanded to honor veterans of all U.S. wars. I found this interesting for two reasons. First, why wasn't Memorial Day older? I would have thought that Memorial Day would have existed earlier. After all, the U.S. was founded with the Revolutionary War. This was followed by the War of 1812, by the Mexican-American War. And all of these would have resulted in a large number of casualties. Shouldn't we remember them? Second, why was it associated with Reunification Day? Perhaps historically, when we remember war, what we focus on is the reason for the war. The Revolutionary War had a specific task of freeing the colonies from England. Thus, the memorial of that war is the 4th of July, which focuses on the Declaration of Independence and freedom. The Civil War had a reason of reunification of the states. However, the end of the fighting was not the end of the task of reunification. That would take many more years. It is easy to suppose that when Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, he was not just attempting to rouse people to continue fighting a war that was brutally wearing them out, but he was already looking ahead to when the fighting ceased and to the work necessary to heal the wounds of the fighting. Listen to his words again. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here, dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. Over time, the great task remaining before us changes from finishing the war to reunification, to abolishing slavery and promoting civil rights, to remembering to work to heal the wounds. Memorial Day, as it came to be called, shifts the focus from the dead to the living and their memories of those dead. Why do we remember the dead? Why should we remember them? Because the living need to look at the past to figure out the future that they want. When Matt Wilson, a professor of neurobiology at MIT's Institute for Learning and Memory, was asked, "Why do we remember unpleasant events better than ordinary ones?" he answered, "We think of memory as a record of our experience, but the idea is not just to store information. It's to store relevant information. The idea is to use our experience to guide future behavior." There's been a lot of really interesting research that points to a connection between our memory of the past and our ability to imagine the future. In terms of brain activity, anticipating the future and remembering the past seem to be related. The speculation is that we process memory in order to solve problems, and things we should learn from, things that are particularly important or that have strong emotions tied to them, may be things that are going to be important in the future. So remembering is important. And remembering historically painful events is perhaps particularly important. How else do we avoid repeating the faults of the past? Let's toss that up into the air as well. Billy Joel in the song, "We Didn't Start the Fire," besides creating a hook that will be stuck in your head for some time to come, does an admirable job at stringing together people and events of recent history into a song that is really nothing more than a list. And it goes on and on. The refrain of this song is like this: "We didn't start the fire. It was always burning since the world's been turning. We didn't start the fire. No, we didn't light it, but we tried to fight it." It's a catchy tune. And it's quite interesting to look up the lyrics and then track down the various references made in the song if you don't already know them. And I didn't know a large number of them. I picked this song because I wanted something that would remind us of our recent history, something that would jog the memory. However, after listening to the song a couple of times, I found two interesting things. First, the list doesn't focus on wars, as Memorial Day does. It covers people. For instance, Joe DiMaggio and Malcolm X are mentioned. Things such as television and the H-bomb, literature and songs, Catcher in the Rye, Rock Around the Clock are mentioned, and historical events such as the assassination of JFK. Second, the chorus confuses me. What does it mean, "we didn't start the fire"? On the one hand, focusing on the "we didn't," it's a statement of denial, as if we are accused of being the root cause of something bad burning through history, as if there's a weaving line of lit gunpowder traveling through time, and we are on the receiving end of its effect, but someone else is to blame. On the other hand, focusing on the start, "we didn't start the fire," it's simply a statement of inheritance. No, we didn't start it, but here it is, burning. We are indeed on the receiving end of the effects of previous history. But more than that, we are actors in our own history. We live it. We are certainly tied to previous history and complicit with it. For example, a person who eats a hamburger is historically involved through a sequence of some events with the slaughter of a cow. Similarly, a person who manufactures a gun is historically involved through a sequence of events with how that gun is used. But if fire is this bad thing traveling through history, why aren't we able to extinguish it? Or more importantly, what are we doing to try and extinguish it? And why are those attempts failing? I don't know the answer, so throw that into the air too. I'm hoping that gravity has ceased to work and that everything will just stay floating. I've never served in the military. The draft ended in 1973 before I was anywhere near the age that the military would want me. I had to register, but that was all. No protesting, fleeing to Canada. No having to make a personal stand for my general avowal of pacifism. I do not have any immediate family members who are currently in the military. I have a brother who served in the Coast Guard. I have a brother-in-law who served in the Navy. Monday is Memorial Day. It comes drifting back down, and with it comes that word, compassion. I'm trying to think of any people I know in the military and coming up with only three, all who served in Desert Storm. I believe all three were pulled out of the National Guard. None were killed or injured. Oddly, I have perhaps a clearer picture of fictional characters and their services. There's Forrest Gump. There's Billy Pilgrim and Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five or The Children's Crusade. There's the old TV show MASH. There's Ishmael and David Gutterson's Snow Falling on Cedars. And there's Yossarian from Joseph Heller's Catch-22. Yossarian in Catch-22 has a conversation that goes like this. "They're trying to kill me," Yossarian told him calmly. "No one's trying to kill you," Clevenger cried. "Then why are they shooting at me?" Yossarian asked. "They're shooting at everyone," Clevenger answered. "They're trying to kill everyone." And what difference does that make? In terms of being shot, there's little difference between being shot at as a specific person or simply as part of a group known as the enemy. War is a great depersonalizer. One sends troops, fights an enemy, captures strategic points on a map. But one does not remember the war. One remembers specific people and events. I think that Memorial Day is not about a category of people who died while serving in the U.S. military. The category is instead a placeholder for a list of specific individuals who served and died, each with his or her own experiences, his or her own reasons for why they served. The act of remembering is specific, just as the graves in Arlington National Cemetery are specific, just as the names on the Vietnam Memorial are specific. I can understand this. These are people. In my initial dislike of Memorial Day, I've tossed a huge number of people into a single group, a class, people who serve in the military. In faulting the class, I have faulted all members of the class without regard for the people that they actually are. If that person were my brother, a friend, a coworker, wouldn't I treat them differently? Even if they are not known to me on a one-by-one basis, shouldn't I treat them each as a special case? Compassion, as Reverend Gilbert notes, requires that I feel what another person feels, that I try and understand their motives and reasoning. People join the military for all kinds of reasons. For some, it is a job, perhaps one in which they bet they will never see an actual war. Others join out of duty, others for economic reasons. Others have been drafted. Some join out of compassion for other people, to defend others, fight for their freedom. My initial thoughts and feelings are coming back down. The surrounding consumerism, patriotism, redundancy, the death that are all bound up in this idea of Memorial Day. I'm going to drop them so I can start over again one more time. Monday is Memorial Day. Why should you participate? Because memory is important. We need it to work toward a future. Because we must reconcile our often violent past with now and with a future that we want. Because we have compassion for all people. And what should we do? We must broaden this narrow view of the world that only remembers its own dead. Our cemeteries are only a partial picture. Each side in a war has one. Both the Confederates and the Union buried their dead. We need to cross borders, unify the world. We need to rethink what the military is and does, because it is one of the largest workforces in the world, and what it means to serve. Kennedy asked us to ask ourselves what we can do for our country, and we should continue to ask ourselves that question. How do I serve? The sermon that Reverend Gilbert wrote was about practicing random acts of kindness and senseless acts of beauty. I want to correct that statement. We need to work toward deliberate acts of kindness and purposeful acts of beauty. We need to open our imaginations to find new ways to look at things. If I may slightly change Michael Ondaatje's words to his sad daughter, they would say, "Don't recall graves. Memory is permanent. Remember the afternoon's yellow suburban annunciation. Your military in its frightening mask dreams perhaps of gentleness." Please stand as you are able and join in the closing hymn, number 131. Thank you. This is a chance for Polylog, if anybody's interested in it. Otherwise, we can adjourn fairly quickly here to the social hall, but I see there's a hand raised. So.
Good morning, I'm Will.
Good morning.
Wow, thanks.
You're welcome.
That was awesome. I just had a moment, too, with my 4-year-old son, Miles, sitting next to me asking me about Memorial Day. And it was the first time I found myself having to describe it. And it's great to know that I'm in a kinship with others that feel the same way, that we think of how we change our world through our actions and how we can pass that on to our children. So thanks so much for your words this morning.
You're really welcome. Important.
Hi, my name is Helen, and I grew up as what they call a military brat. My dad was 27 years in the military as a job, and he served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And none of us as children, we saw a lot of things going on, the prisoners of war coming back. And we asked a lot of questions. My dad didn't hide a lot of things. But I think a lot of the people that he was around, he was a very compassionate person. So I think, especially when he was in Vietnam, that's most of the time that I experienced with him, he said, you know, we need compassionate people there. Because at that time, the Vietnamese were not compassionate to each other. So he says, we need to demonstrate compassion, even though we're there in a place that we're not wanted. And those are the things I try and hang on to, because that was a job for him, but he also had to show compassion to the others around him. So he would tell us and write letters. That was when we wrote letters or did the reel-to-reel tape recordings. And he would kind of have, you know, other people on the tape. So we would know that the other people around were also compassionate individuals. Not everybody was mean. And he was there to show, you know, that Americans aren't, you know, just bent on, you know, destroying everything.
Thank you. I like hearing the word compassion again. That's the word I focused on. And I think, again, it's something we focus on because it's a human thing. It's not something, war is not compassionate. The people who are making war can be compassionate even within that structure. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Al. And Paul, like you, I wasn't necessarily near to being the age of draft. I graduated high school in 76, so as a freshman it was over. I was convinced, there's no way I'm going to Canada. Sometime later I saw the movie Deer Hunter, and I felt, not for the first time in my life, stupid, that how do you know till you know the time is present? But I think a lot of times we have beliefs of what we think we would do until we're faced with them, and perhaps it's beneficial to reflect that you don't know until you're actually faced with that. I appreciate your words and thought of compassion, and I can do that in an individual approach to those that are soldiers, generals involved. I have challenge being compassionate to the machine of war. I have challenge being compassionate to those that have the strength and the power taking and making right in their minds and in their way. Yes, I think that there have been times where military actions have perhaps bettered a situation. But again, going back to the beginning, how do I know unless I'm really there what is better?
Thank you. I don't have answers for that. I think that's the best we can do, is continue to struggle with that.
Thanks for a little bit of fresh air this morning. I'm going to go back outside and wade back into... I'm sorry, Eric Moraine. Sorry. I'm going to go back outside and wade back into the group psychosis. Part of what happens for me on Memorial Day is that we all get together and drink the Kool-Aid of how we, in quotes, we are supposed to feel. I'm just thinking about an email. I want to read a few sentences. I got that this morning. I read it before I left for church here. this, and I struggle with how do I engage this? You know, this is the community I live in. Also, a huge thanks goes out to all veterans everywhere this Memorial Day of both the four-legged and two-legged varieties. May God bless you for your sacrifice to keep our country free for all citizens, including those who do not appreciate the military, those who are not citizens, and those many of us who often take for granted the ultimate sacrifices that have been made to make our home the shining city on a hill that it is today. God bless the USA this Memorial Day, 2010. Thank you, sir. May I have another? I don't know how to engage that, and I feel as though that's what I'm going to be walking around in on Monday. What are you going to walk around in on Monday?
Hi, Barb again. It was a privilege to catch the Dalai Lama on the Today Show a week ago. And his feeling about this century is that we are finally going to, we have been in a place where it's all about power, and that we are taking a step up in the energetic world towards love. And he explained that very beautifully and briefly by the recent catastrophes that have happened around the world. This is the first time in the history of mankind that many nations have come together to help people in one nation when something bad happens to them. So hopefully it's a step away from raising our sons and daughters to believe that violence is the way to another way, a more compassionate way.
Definitely. I think the issue still comes down to that us and them mentality that's underneath there. And how do we break that down? How do we join ourselves? If it takes a disaster, maybe that's what it takes.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I didn't plan to speak until you mentioned the Dalai Lama. And I'm just currently reading a book by John London, spelled L-U-N-D-I-N. It's called The New Mandala, and it's co-written with the Dalai Lama. And I'm almost totally done. And so much of it deals with compassion and your meditation, and that the way to really reach this point of peace and compassion is to meditate on your enemy. Mm-hmm. And that the compassion for that person come. So I don't know, it's a great book. I don't understand all of it, and I was going to suggest eventually that maybe we do a book, you know, read it as a small group or something and do a discussion on it. But maybe people can help me understand and how to get to that point. That seems to be a very, very difficult point to get to.
Definitely. Thank you.
My name is Robin, and I was a conscientious objector. And through all these wars that I've watched, there's been a glaring neglect of what's happening to the enemy, and are they really evil? And it usually turns out that after the war is over, we kind of shake hands and discover that they're not really bad people. And I'm reminded of a veteran who spoke at a UN meeting, who said that he had gone back to Vietnam after many years, and had found that the people were just wonderful and welcoming. And he said that his thoughts were that I've looked into the eyes of my enemy, and let's see if I can remember this correctly, but to hate him would be suicide, but to reach out my hand could save the world.
My name is Terry, and I grew up in Iowa, and my grandmother lived with us. And every Memorial Day, when everyone else was shopping the sales, I guess, and doing the picnics, we drove to every cemetery in Iowa, and it's always a race to see if we had enough iris, you know, that bloomed, and we took our homegrown flowers and put them on every great aunt and great uncle, whether they'd served in the military or not, and it was a day of sharing stories about family history and remembering all of those that had passed. And I think it's kind of sad that we've forgotten that aspect of Memorial Day and that we probably don't share family history and put a face to family history anymore with our children. And it was kind of a lovely tradition, actually.
I think, again, that's the focus, again, on that personal, the family. These are people in your family, people you know, or you learn about them as you go, as opposed to you go to Arlington and there's rows and rows of crosses. Who are these people? Why did they do this? How did they end up here? Those are the stories that are interesting. And to Robin's point as well, it's half a cemetery at best. You're standing in your cemetery. What happened to the people that they fought?
Paul, you ask an interesting question. Why was there no Memorial Day until after the Civil War? And I can't answer that question. But I can tell you something about the origin of Memorial Day that shows how complicated this issue really is. The origins were in Charleston, South Carolina, the home of the Confederacy, the state with the highest percentage of slaves in the Union, the state that actually, the first shot of the Civil War was fired in Charleston Harbor at Fort Sumter. At the end of the war, 10,000 former slaves went to a place called what is called Hampton Park today. That area had been used as a POW camp for Union soldiers. And about several hundred of them had died of exposure, malnutrition, et cetera, and lay in shallow graves. On the first Memorial Day, these 10,000 former slaves dug up the remains, held ceremonies. They didn't call it Memorial Day. But that was really, that's the origin of it. It's something that was forgotten for many years until a historian at Yale recently was able to document it in pretty substantially. But it does show the complications, the complexities of what Memorial Day can mean. It never means the same thing is the problem.
I think that's one of the points I want to stress again as well, is that it changes with the meaning we give to it. Historically, it's moved from one thing to another, and that's our job. That's for us, the living, to continue to say, what does this mean for us going onward? Is there anyone else? I have closing words then. Frances Moore, I don't know how to say her last name, Frances Moore Lape, writer and activist. She was 26 years old when she began the research that led to the publication of a book called Diet for a Small Planet, a book that changed the way people think about food. She showed that food scarcity results when grain is fed to livestock to produce meat. So most of you have heard this. 16 pounds of grain, soy protein, are needed to produce 1 pound of meat protein. Today, she is focusing her attention on communities of people around the world who, when their governments have failed to address their needs, have democratically organized themselves to protect their culture and advance themselves economically and politically. And she says, "What an extraordinary time to be alive. We're the first people on the planet to have real choice. We can continue killing each other, wiping out other species, spoiling our nest. Yet on every continent, a revolution in human dignity is emerging. It is reknitting community and our ties to the earth. So we do have a choice. We can choose death, or we can choose life. It's the wake-up call.